it's really hard to be authentic when you're 25 and trying to figure out your life. Maybe I was my most authentic self then, but my authentic self was confused. So I think don't be so hard on yourself, right? I think that sometimes people say, I'm not being authentic. Well, what does that mean? Well, it's whatever it means to you. There is no truth. There's no ground truth of who you are, right? It's flexible. It changes. And you grow and you learn.
Welcome to Sidebars, Kilpatrick Townsend's limited podcast series focused on women in patent law. I'm April Isaacson, a patent litigator and partner in the San Francisco office.
And I'm Kim Davis, a patent prosecutor and partner in the Atlanta office. We're here to discuss the gender gap in the patent bar and have candid conversations with female patent practitioners on their career paths.
Welcome back to Sidebars. I'm Kim Davis, and I'm here with my awesome co-host, the one and only April Isaacson. Okay, listeners, now I know I always say this, I know it, but it doesn't make it any less true. We have a treat in store for all of you today. So patent law in my day was considered an alternative career path, meaning no academia, no industry, you're on that alternative track. But what about those who are interested in an alternative to the alternative? For those of you interested in non-traditional careers in patent law, and I mean by when I say that, I mean not as an agent, you may find some very useful nuggets in hearing from today's guest, Stephanie Sanders. Stephanie hails from Long Island, New York, and completed her Bachelor's of Science at Binghamton University, where she majored in computer engineering. She then attended law school at George Washington. Stephanie has been a patent examiner, a patent attorney, an intellectual property training manager, and then the director of intellectual property operations. Stephanie is now the global patent operations chief at Kilpatrick Townsend in Stockton, where, according to her firm bio, she works to make sure that our IP teams introduce efficiencies and improve our patent prosecution practice. In other words, between the two of us, listeners, she keeps us all in line. Stephanie, welcome to Sidebars.
Thank you so much, Kim. It's such a pleasure to be here. I'm so excited to talk to you in April.
Oh, we're super excited about this conversation. So we're going to start off the same way we start off all of our discussions, but I want you to feel at liberty to take us as far back along the path as you need to give us the full picture. Stephanie, what made you pivot from science to law?
So when I was in high school, I didn't really have a plan. I was, I think, the opposite of you, Kim, in a lot of ways, where you always knew where you were going and how you were getting there. I didn't really know. In fact, in preparation for this interview, I asked my sister if she remembers me ever saying there was something I wanted to be when I grew up. And she said, other than a tap dancer, no. And I said, well, I'm glad that I didn't stick with that because I don't think that would have gone over too well. As I had gotten older, I think there's probably an expiration date for tap dancers unless you're uber famous. So I remember when I was in high school applying for colleges and having no real direction and picking schools kind of based on where my friends were thinking and applying to schools. But it's funny because my mother said, I don't know why you're wasting your money because you're going to a state school. So I ended up getting into Binghamton, which at the time, and I assume still is, the gem of the State University of New York system. Although I also got into Stony Brook, but that was way too close to home. So I decided to head to the southern tier there.
Well, I know Binghamton is number one publicly ranked university in the state of New York, by the way.
And so I applied with no real thoughts on what my major might be. So when I was a senior, I took a class on computer programming. And this was back in the, can you make a DOS cursor blink?
What was it that made you decide to take that class?
That's a great question, April. I actually was trying to remember and I don't know. Isn't that crazy? Like, something just, I don't know if it was divine intervention or what, but I needed a class and I signed up for that one. I think that I did enjoy my Commodore 64. I certainly was not a super nerdy person who was taking the whole thing apart and trying to program it. Like, you know, I did have friends who were doing that, but I liked the idea of computers. And so, yeah, so I signed up for this class and I really liked it. I really liked figuring out the puzzle of how do I make this machine do something. So about halfway through that class, I said, I wonder if I could get into computer science at Binghamton. They've already accepted me. They can't say no at this point. So I called the Watson School of Engineering and Applied Sciences, and I spoke with someone and they said, sorry, our computer science, our CS program is full, but if you want to be an engineering major, you can join us for that. And I said, well, I don't know anything about engineering. I'm not sure. And they said, well, you could start in engineering and switch to computer science. And I said, sold. I'll take it. So I showed up on campus as an engineering major for the first 2 years, at least at Binghamton in the Watson School. You did a common curriculum. So I didn't have to pick a major in my major at that point. But I loved it. I just loved everything about being an engineering major. I loved Binghamton because I could have my little 100 plus group of engineers, and then I could have this whole big university around me. And as I know that Kim and April know about me, and as the listeners will learn, I have a big personality. So having a place where I can let that grow was really good for me, I think. So I was in my engineering major. I was having lots of fun. I was enjoying it. And time passed and I never switched to computer science. I just didn't do it.
If I can interject, I think we like to think of ourselves, you know, people say patent geek is kind of redundant, but I like to think of us as like the cool nerds. But the one thing I'll say is you have that capacity, but also the soft skills in terms of really connecting with people. Can you talk about where that comes from?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, thank you. I've always been a chatterbox, and I've always liked being around people. When I got to campus, the first thing that went through my head was, oh, this RA thing seems cool. I want to do that. Nobody else has that thought. Everyone else is like, the RA is a super dork. And I was like, yay, these are my people.
I was an RA in graduate school, but part of it was wanting to connect with people, but some of it was financial. So was that a combination of things for you?
Yes, definitely. But I'm pretty sure had I not, my first thought was not, this is a way to make money. My first thought was, this is awesome. I get to be in charge. I get to meet everybody, do all the activities, hold the keys. Who doesn't want to hold the keys? And yes, certainly I had work study and I had to work my whole way through college. And so certainly the free room and board was a bonus, but that was not the driving factor, shall we say. So I've always enjoyed people. What I found when I was in my engineering major, in my engineering classes, particularly in labs, is that I liked the technology, but I wasn't super duper technical. So I was not the geekiest of geeks. I wasn't the person that anyone in my class would come to if they couldn't figure out, you know, a line of code or how to make this or that work. But I was the person that people wanted on their team because I would write the report. I knew how to get a printout onto a transparency. I also worked in the office of the electrical engineering chair, who was, I kid you not, Professor Plum. So I also had access to lots of fun office equipment, which was super.
You were the person to know, basically, right? You were the person to know.
I was the person to know. Right. Thank you. Yes. But I think what it comes down to is that I would give a presentation. Like, to me, that was no big deal, right? I would stand up and I would say, here's our thing. This is what it does. This is how it does it. And it never occurred to me that that was something that other people couldn't do.
And was it something that you found that you not only had the talent to do and other people maybe couldn't do, but they didn't want to do as well? So then it kind of fell to you. Is that how it worked?
Absolutely. There's been pluses and minuses to that, which I think maybe we'll talk about in a little bit. But yeah, absolutely. If I would say, you know, hey, can I speak? People would be like, sure, you know, no problem. And certainly there were people, gradations, you know, in my class who were happy to speak. But for the most part, yeah, if I wanted to give the presentation or I wanted to design the the overhead or I wanted to write up the report, people were psyched to have me do that. And I just, it's always just been a part of me, to answer your question, April, about where that came from, or maybe it was Kim, I'm sorry. I don't know. When I was in law school, I had a very good friend who said something to me about, you know, not everybody is outgoing and not everybody wants to stand up and speak. And some people are shy. And this is maybe not a best place to share this story, but I said, I don't even understand shy. Like, what is shy? And she said to me, oh gosh, Stephanie, but I just don't, it would never occur to me to not want to stand up in front of a group of people and talk. And so as I progressed in my undergraduate career, it became very clear to me that I was not the most technical person. If you were going to put me into a room and have me write code, I would probably have jumped out of a window. It just sounded awful to me to be by myself doing that sort of work. So all I saw at that point was, I don't want to do this. This is what my peers are doing. These are the jobs they are going out to get. These are the internships they're getting. I don't want to do that. Crap. What does that mean for me? And there was a lot of like, well, I'm not good enough, right? A lot of, I'm not as good at this as they are. My grades were good. I've always been good at school, but I wasn't building computers, you know, in my spare time. And
do you think at that point, then, you weren't really fully aware of these communication skills and abilities to connect and being hard on yourself for thinking that you were lacking in the technical?
Absolutely. I had no idea that these other parts of me were skills, let alone marketable skills. I had no idea. I didn't know someone would pay me because I like to talk. That had never occurred to me. Now, I should say my mom is a psychologist, so I knew you could get paid to talk or to listen, I guess, in her case. But yeah, it was all about the what I couldn't do.
In your case, I would say it's not to talk, but because you have something to say and to communicate.
That's right. Thank you, April. Yes, that's right. And so I was floundering. I didn't know what to do. And graduation was fast approaching. I had a lot of interviews. I had one job offer, which was a sales job, which in retrospect might have actually been a decent fit. Unfortunately, the job was in Allentown, Pennsylvania, and I was 22 years old and wasn't super psyched on going there. No offense, listeners, if you're from Allentown, I'm sure it's a wonderful place. Great Billy Joel song.
I'm not from Allentown, but I'm from the middle of nowhere, Pennsylvania, so I won't take offense.
Okay, good. Well, thank you, April. I couldn't see myself doing that. And so I graduated and Kim, it wasn't a pivot. It was more of a plop. You know, I just didn't even know what I was meant to do. And I would say there was probably some depression at the time because this was a point in my life where I had no plan. And again, not that, you know, I had planned everything out to the minute, but I knew I was going to do well in high school and go to college and do well there and get a good job and, you know, move along. But I really had no idea what to do with myself. So this is where I think you can tell me if this is the pivot or not the pivot, but an inflection point was I was laying around on the couch at my mom's house watching way too much Carson Daly on Total Request Live. If you don't know what that is, my apologies. And my mother, who was tired of me after, I don't know, 2 weeks, got on the computer and she asked Jeeves. I'm pretty sure she asked Jeeves. My sister said she just went out to AOL, you know, and typed it into the search engine. But I think she asked Jeeves, so we're going to go with that. So my mother asked, yeah, right? That's good. So my mother asked Jeeves.
And we're putting ourselves in the 2001 timeframe with Ask Jeeves as well as Total Request Live, where I believe it was Bye 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 by NSYNC that you were requesting. Yeah,
absolutely. Okay. I did call. I called kind of a lot, actually. I didn't have anything else to do. So my mother asked Jeeves, who will hire a graduate with an engineering degree? And up popped the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. I'd never heard of a patent. I didn't know what a patent was. They were in Virginia. I didn't know anyone south of Hoboken. I had never been to Virginia. You know, the whole thing was a little bit crazy, but my mom was over me. And so she got me up. She sat me down and she said, read this, apply for this. Now, I should say I wasn't being a total slob or, you know, lazy person. I had been applying for jobs, but I was so directionless that I'm sure if you looked at those applications, the people reading them were probably like, okay, so she got a book out of the library on how to apply for jobs on monster.com. And that's it. Like, she has no passion for anything.
Would it be safe to say that you were feeling lost at that point?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, totally. I just didn't know what to do with myself. And I had some friends who graduated without a job. I had some who were going on to grad school. I just felt like I was the only one. I was the only one who didn't know what to do with myself. So I sat down. I applied for the job at the patent office and couldn't have been a week. And I got a phone call to have an interview on the phone. An interview on the phone, not a request to come to interview, an interview on the phone. So back to April's point, this was 2001. Patents were blowing up and they didn't have enough examiners. And they certainly didn't have enough with computer science, computer engineering backgrounds. And so they were psyched to see my resume. So I got a phone call and who would be my future supervisory patent examiner or SPE essentially offered me the job over the phone. And it was crazy. And then I think a day later, another SPE called me and tried to offer me the job. And I was like, do you guys not talk to each other? I already talked to this guy. I came down to Arlington, Virginia. I went and met some folks at the patent office and boom, I was a patent examiner. I'm not sure that I pivoted so much from the sciences as I was in this science funnel and then it ended. But it turned out there was, after all, a slide. And that slide went down to, into the patent world.
There you go. And I love that. And I will find, I don't know how I feel about that, Stephanie. You said if you pointed to one point of your path and said, well, maybe this is where the pivot happened. But it's almost like you were born to just use the tools of science, but in another arena, right? Because of all of those soft skills that you had. You aligned with, who was it? Professor Plum was the head of, you aligned yourself with the folks who could make things happen, right? And that in turn allowed you to provide additional to the folks that you interacted with. Didn't matter that you weren't like the top coder. Everybody still wanted you because of those other skills. So I love it. I love it. I find that there were a few points. So yeah, tell us about life as a patent examiner. How did that go?
Oh, Kim, when you think of the most exciting, fun-filled, party-like yes. atmosphere, take that, reverse it. That was the patent office.
Do we need a disclaimer here? Because Kim is a practicing patent practitioner and coordinates with the PTO on a daily basis.
Well, I was going to say that the patent office was a fantastic experience. I really did enjoy working there. I learned a lot. And I really think that I found out a lot about myself by working there. It was not fancy. It was not snazzy. They were in their old building in Crystal City with all the undergrounds. There was nothing flashy about it. You know, I had interviewed, one of the jobs I interviewed for was a job with Goldman Sachs. And that was flashy, as you can imagine. And this was the total opposite. This was a whole group of people wearing pleated front khakis and polo shirts and getting down to business. But I will tell you, I walked in there. They had a great training program. It was way shorter then than it is now. They've really improved upon it. They taught me what I needed to know and I did my work and I learned about patents, which I had never heard anything about. And I learned about the importance of patents and I learned about how I could use my knowledge of technology without actually making something myself, right? And so I found out that, oh, I don't have to be the maker. I don't have to be the creator. I can have this knowledge and this interest in this area. And that in and of itself is useful. It gave me an opportunity to do research. It gave me an opportunity to write. It was really the first time I had to write anything because Binghamton had, at least at the time, somehow finagled it so that some of our engineering courses counted our lab reports for our writing requirement, which at the time I thought was great. I'm not sure that I would, that if I had it to do it again, I would probably take a few other writing classes on my own. But I had the opportunity to write at the patent office. I had the opportunity to have someone review my work and give me instant feedback. And so I learned a lot. It really showed me that there was something to this whole, I like science, I like computers thing that I could do without being the maker or the creator there. So no disrespect to the patent office.
For you being at the patent office and being exposed to the technology and looking at it through the prism of law, how did that make you look at going to law school?
So about 5 minutes in, I was looking for the next thing to do. Because one of the things I forgot to mention before is that I am always looking for the next thing. I looked around and I said, okay, this is cool. I like this. I want to check this out. But wait a minute, there's this other person involved in this process, this patent attorney. What is that about? And so I remember one of the first interviews I had, well, I guess I was being interviewed. I asked the attorney, I said, how'd you become a patent attorney? What's that like? And the person said, well, I have a background similar to yours and I went to law school. And I said, I can do that. That can't be hard. So I signed up for an LSAT prep class and I thought I was being very fancy. I got on the metro, went to DuPont Circle to take my little class. I know, very fancy, you know, once a week. And I took the LSAT and I did okay. You know, I didn't do great. I wasn't studying that hard. I did okay. But yeah, I applied to law school and I went. And honestly, I will say that there were two reasons that I decided to do that. One, I liked the idea that this was a specific path that I could select, right? There was some power in that to say, oh, okay, patent examiner, that's good. But now I see something that I can work towards. I'm going to go do that. So that was first. Second, I love school. If I was independently wealthy, I would just go to school and rack up degrees for the rest of my life. So that was great. And then third, the work that the patent examiners do requires a lot of concentration and a lot of research and a lot of thoughtfulness. It does not require a lot of talking. In fact, it doesn't help you very much if you're up and about and chit-chatting with everybody around the hallway, because you have a production system and you need to get your work done. I think that the context, the way in which patent examiners spend their days, was just not a good fit for me. I think it was very similar to that sitting in a room, writing code, only getting up because you realize you're starving and you haven't eaten in 2 days. So the context was not the right fit, or at least that specific role was not the right fit, but the patent universe, I think, really put me on that path of starting to realize that, okay, this science stuff is cool and I like it and I can do it and that's great. But there's this other part of me that is valuable, right? This whole being able to communicate that, being able to talk to other people, being able to write really did have some value. So off I went to law school.
So was it like every other school experience where you immediately loved it? I know you were laser focused on patents, but did you love the, I don't know, con law and property and all of the other aspects?
I loved law school, but not for the reason you suggest. I loved it because it was all about people, right? Being an engineering student, you know, you go to your class, you talk to people a little bit, you do your tests, you go home, right? But in law school, you did things in groups, right? When you were doing your moot court, you had a partner. When you were in your small legal research and writing class, there were 10 of you and you were all scared. So you all talked. I liked that aspect of it. I will tell you, listeners, I was freaked out. I thought there's no way that I am going to figure any of this stuff out. I remember going to con law and someone raising their hand and saying something that I thought was the most brilliant thing I had ever heard in my entire life and going, oh my God, I just spent the past 5 years thinking about branch predictors and pipelines and all of this computer geeky stuff. I'm in trouble here. And so I remember getting out of that class and saying to someone, you know, one of my friends, oh my God, that person, I can't believe they knew that. And she said, they must have taken con law in undergrad. They're just regurgitating what that professor said. They don't know anything special. I was like, oh, whew, okay.
Yeah, they'd already read Tribe and you didn't even know who Tribe was.
Exactly. Correct. I thought it was a tribe called Quest. Like I had no idea, you know. So absolutely.
Well, let me ask you, I know that when I was in law school, there were a few of us that had technical degrees, and some of the students that I was friends with struggled first year, particularly the engineering students, because to your point, they weren't used to taking essay tests. They were used to more, you know, kind of multiple choice. How was first year of law school for you in that respect?
It was definitely different and it was harder. I would say some of the concept that there is no answer was both liberating and frustrating. So I did like that you could argue your way into or out of an answer. I thought that was very liberating, but I also found it frustrating because a lot of times I want to say, well, just tell me, what is the answer? And they would say, you know, there is no answer necessarily. So that was challenging to me. It did take me a while to find my groove on the writing essay type tests instead of just doing the problem and showing your work. But it did occur to me at some point that it's kind of like doing the problem and showing your work, right? If you look at the IRAC, really, that's just it's what it is. It's a formula. I could do that. That part was easy. You tell me how you want it. I will give it to you that way. It's following a set of instructions. It's just like a computer program. And they said, this is how you brief a case. So I briefed the cases, every single one till the day I graduated. I was the only person who did that. I mean, my outlines, guys, the highlighters, whew, the flags, it was gorgeous. I think that some of the things that I am good at that I learned through my engineering experience did serve me well. It was a little bit harder, though, to get used to those ideas of there's no answer, things like that.
It's safe to say you were the most prepared student, right? Or close to it. You used your preparation.
Yeah, I was very prepared. I'm not sure I always knew what exactly I was doing, but certainly when I got, I will never, ever forget this, the second semester, first day of my 1L second semester in civil procedure, we're all sitting there. Everyone's feeling cool, right? Because it's second semester. So now, you know, they know everything, right? And I'm sitting there in my seat and our professor, who we had had first semester, walks in. Oh, no, I take it back. He was a new professor because the professor we had had for Civ Pro 1 was not teaching 2. So it was this new professor. We didn't know him. He walks in the door. He starts walking down the steps and calls on me. And my heart like flip-flopped. And I will never forget, for some reason, I was wearing one of those headbands that has all the teeth in it. I just felt the teeth on my head in that headband. But I had my brief. And so I just took it out and I started. I don't know what I said, but at least I had something to say. So I was very prepared. And I did take a class with that same professor later on, and he did come in on the first day and call on me, you know, throwback, which I thought was very amusing. And I did have my brief then too, so I got it.
So then when you were in law school, did you ever have a sense of the imposter syndrome based on what you're talking about right now?
Oh yeah, definitely. I would say I spent at least the whole first year realizing that someone was going to say, you should not be here. There is no reason you should be in law school. You didn't do pre-law. You don't know anything about law. You didn't really like LA law. You weren't a big Ally McBeal fan. Like I was pretty sure that people were going to just say, this was a mistake, particularly because I got into GW, which is a great school and very good for IP. And I definitely had this feeling like, oh, they only let me in because I'm a patent examiner and that looks good for their IP ranking.
Do you remember the moment or maybe just a period when you realized I belong in the room? I deserve and I'm supposed to be here.
I think part of me is still waiting for that day, April, to be honest. I think that never really came. There were certainly moments when I felt like, okay, I'm okay. I'm not going to flame out. But certainly, you know, I remember having interviews for summer associate positions, and I had it was back in the party days. And so I had a lot of offers. And I just remember thinking, these people are so stupid. Like, what? Why are they giving me all of these offers? They have no idea. I don't know anything about the law. I've been in law school for a year. I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know anything. I definitely felt that. I felt that when I was a summer associate. I felt like they are going to figure out that I actually know nothing, that I was an examiner for a year, but I didn't really learn anything. It really did go on and on. I've gotten more comfortable with myself as I've gone on. But I would say the imposter syndrome didn't really start to dissipate until after I decided to stop practicing, actually.
Well, let's go there. I would love to take us to that point. So I do know you accepted one of those offers that you received. And so you were a big law practicing attorney at some point. Tell us about that and how that helped you to move along to find your true calling.
So I did accept one of those offers, and I was a summer associate, and I received an offer to join the firm. And I did after I took and passed the New York bar. And I did patent prosecution. And I did that for a number of partners, a number of clients. I liked it. I felt like I was pretty good at it. I soaked up every tiny bit of training and information that was sent my way. But I hit the same stumbling block that it was very isolating. The work was very isolating. And in order to bill 7.5 hours a day, did you guys know this? Like, all the time you're not working on cases doesn't count. So like, if you're walking around talking to people, it doesn't count. I got to my first review, and my hours were always low, but I got to my first review, and I remember thinking like, okay, well, my hours are not great, but I created a series of helpful practices lunches for the first years. I volunteered to do the case lunch 3 times. I interviewed every single summer associate candidate and went to every summer associate event. I did this, 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 and this. And I sat there and I got the your hours are low speech. And I said, but look at all these things that I've done for the firm. They're like, but your hours are low. But you asked me to do these things, but your hours were low.
Do you think that some of those extras that you did that maybe weren't fully getting appreciated related to the fact that you're a woman?
Yes, absolutely. 100%.
Can you talk about that?
So this is where, when I said before that these things have gotten me a little bit in trouble. So when I was in college for my senior design project, I will never forget the professor introduced the team to our client. Our client was from industry and introduced me as the secretary, which was not the nicest thing ever. But he had a point, not a good one, but he had a point in that I was the person who was taking the notes, and I was the person who was being organized, and I was the person who was calling everybody to set up the meeting, right? You didn't have doodles back then. And so I was serving in that function. Now, of course, the downside, as we all know, is the negative connotation to the term secretary when you're in a group of men and you are the only woman. And so when I was at the firm, and anyone would ask for a volunteer for anything, my natural inclination is to volunteer. My natural inclination is to go towards the thing that is social and to go towards the thing that will help, right? It was my idea. You know, someone said it would be great if the partners would tell us things. Couldn't we just have a class on time narratives or whatever it was? And I said, oh, yeah, I'll organize that. I'll make that happen. And I did, and everyone loved it, and it was super great, but it didn't count. And so the question is it the fact that I am a woman? Is it the fact that these are parts of my personality and things that I'm good at? Is it I have those things as part of my personality and I'm good at them because I'm a woman? I don't know.
And so much of it, it's inextricably intertwined. And I find myself asking the same question. Even now, being a lawyer for 26 years, is it that I'm being kind of taken advantage of for some of those things, or am I allowing it to happen? And I think it's a combination of the two things. I don't know how you feel about that.
I think that's right. I think I just, honestly, I couldn't help myself. I cannot be in a situation where I don't take notes, where I don't take charge. I was at a friend's, one of my best friends was getting married, and this was quite some time ago, and we were at his rehearsal and everything was a mess. Like, people were just running around and talking. And all of a sudden I clapped my hands and I said, people, we are paying attention now. And that's just who I am. And I can't not do that. And I don't know what role gender plays in that, but I know it's some role.
Can you talk about then, you ultimately, we know, decided not to stay in big law as a practitioner. Can you talk to us about that transition out of big law in terms of not practicing law?
Yeah. So I did it twice because it takes me a while to learn my lessons. And so, you know, I tried a few things while I was at my firm. I really did like the people, but things just went really downhill after, I would say, the second year when I had the your hours are too low conversation. I decided to switch to litigation, thinking, okay, it'll be easier to get hours, right? You know, I hear it's easier.
Not true.
Not true.
Not, say.
Not true.
Kidding.
I've heard that from many a patent practitioner that they think that in litigation, but no, it is not true.
Also, it still doesn't count if you're just chit-chatting. Fun fact, that doesn't change. So I switched to litigation, and I will say it did help a little bit. It is a little easier to block your time, right? If you're working on a brief or you're working on, you know, a memo, it's easier to do to say, I worked on that for these 4 hours.
Not anymore, by the way.
I know. Well, I was going to say that things have changed, but it was easier to do that when you're not touching 10 files a day. So there was some of that, but ultimately it was not enough. And there were a couple things that made me decide to leave the law, and not just leave big law, but to leave the law at the time completely. One of the things was that I was just too damn efficient. And I remember being in a room, it had to be 11 o'clock at night, and a partner was hemming and hawing over a comma. And I just remember thinking, this is BS. Why are we doing this? I was done with this, whatever it was, 2 hours ago. I'm done. Like, I want to go home. And there was a lot of that because I was very efficient. I don't have time for going back and forth. When I'm done, I'm done. There was, going back to law school, I once left a 3-hour exam after an hour and 20 minutes because I was done. And people were like angry with me, but I was done. I wasn't going to get a better grade if I sat there another hour and 40 minutes. So I left. Anyway, so I think there was, you know, one of the reasons I left was it just was very counter. This whole hours business was just very counter to how I live my life, right? I want to get things done in as efficient a way as possible. I want to be able to have time built into my day to chit chat and talk to people and build meaningful relationships. I want to do these other things that I think are valuable. And then the other component was that I had no life. I was working all the time. People would say things to me like, well, Stephanie's not married. She doesn't have to leave. Stephanie doesn't have kids. She doesn't have to go home.
I'm very familiar with that concept, by the way.
Oh, my God. I actually remember saying to a partner once, I remember saying like, well, how am I ever going to meet anyone if I'm always here?
They want you to meet them there.
I don't have a good filter. Yeah, exactly. I'm like, no, this is patent law. The odds are good, but the goods are odd.
Do you think that I found that with regard to the you're single, don't have children, so you can be available to fly to Brussels to cover some emergency deposition at the last minute because you have no life? I find sometimes women are a little bit harder on other women than men are. Have you found that to be your experience?
I did not. And the reason for that is at this particular firm, there were 4 women partners in my office with whom I had any interaction. And I didn't really work with any of them. And I've thought about that since, actually, and I'm not sure why that happened. I don't know if it was a technology thing or a client thing, but I just never really worked with them, which I thought was kind of interesting. So, you know, I had no life and I wasn't getting from work what I wanted to. And I was depressed. I had floundered a little bit. I had found a path. I was super excited. I got on the patent attorney train. I did everything I was told to do. And yet somehow I was failing because I could not bill these hours, even though I was working all the time. And I had nothing else happening in my life. And I was just super duper depressed. I felt like, what on earth am I going to do now? And it was very, very bad.
Was it another instance where you felt lost, so to speak?
I did. I did feel lost. But I think at this point, it was harder because I felt like I was doing my best, right? When I graduated from school, I was lost. I didn't really know what I wanted to do or where I was going to go. But it's not like I was trying anything and failing. Here, I felt like I was failing. I felt like everything I had in my toolbox was no longer right for the job. And I thought I was a pretty good attorney. I still think I was a pretty good patent attorney. I've had people who took on, you know, my cases after I left say I did a good job. You know, I don't think that was the issue. And the fact that the quality of my work seemed to have very little bearing on my success, at least at that point in time, at that place. And perhaps I'm being a little harsh on them. I'm sure if my work was bad, I would have been out of there much sooner, but it was heartbreaking. And I was depressed and I had asked them for some time and I ended up taking a month. I ended up taking a leave of absence. And during that time, I really thought about what do I want to do with myself because this is clearly not working.
When you say that you felt like you were failing, it sounds like that was you judging yourself as a failure as opposed to getting feedback from others. Is that accurate?
Yes, at least on a day-to-day basis. But I think the overall message was you have to bill these hours and you're not. And that is the one and only criteria. Now, that may not have been true, but that was the message that I received.
And it's interesting because we have, what does success mean? In your instance, was it you thinking you were not being successful because you weren't billing enough hours?
It was me thinking I wasn't being successful because they told me over and over again, you are not meeting the hours requirement. You need to bill more hours. And I physically could not work any more than I was working. Now, could I have maybe not spent an hour chit-chatting or going for a coffee or getting lunch or whatever? Honestly, I don't think so. I think it would have been way worse for me if I didn't do that. That was the only thing that was keeping me hanging on was my relationships to other people.
And you need to eat. Let's add that in there. I think that's an important part.
To be fair.
No, it's amazing that you added a few minutes ago, you mentioned at that time, this just wasn't working for them. I'm fast forwarding into the future. We know there are so many other models that play other than the billable hour model that are being tossed around. And I wonder if you were at that time, you know, where Stephanie Sanders would be today. Just curious, especially since you enjoyed the work, right? Essentially, you enjoyed doing it.
Yeah. So I tried to go into that future. I applied for some in-house positions thinking back then, right? It was, oh, well, in-house is way easier. You don't have to bill your time. Ha ha. So I was just not quite experienced enough. I just kept getting people saying, well, you were fourth year. If you were a four and a half year or you were a fifth year, I just kept missing out. I just didn't have enough experience. And so I don't know what that alternate universe would have looked like. Had I gone on to a firm that did not have such high billing requirement, you know, or I had gone in-house and I didn't have to bill my time and my efficiency was appreciated a little bit more. I don't know.
Earlier, you mentioned that where you were working, there were four female partners and you hadn't worked with any of them. Can you talk about any of the sort of gender bias or things of that nature that you dealt with working at a law firm at that time?
Well, I'll tell a story. So when I was interviewing for summer associate positions at this particular firm, I was told they had a women's group and that they had a monthly women's lunch. And I said, that's amazing. I want to make friends with all of the women. So I showed up as a summer and a few weeks went by and I saw one of the female partners and I went up to her and I said, hey, you know, I'm really looking forward to it. When is the women's lunch? And she looked at me like I caught her with her pants down. And she said, oh, yes, soon. So what I can only assume was a hastily planned lunch was put together for my benefit. I should mention I was the only female summer associate. And it was the most awkward thing. It was so clear that these people were not friends. They don't have to be friends. There's no reason to be friends with people just because they are the same X, Y, or Z as you, right? The same gender, the same whatever. But the thing that annoyed me was that, like, why say you have it right if you don't? What is the point of that? So that was very awkward. For the record, when I joined the firm as an associate, there was never, ever again another woman's lunch, at least not that one that I was invited to. So that was strange and awkward. Certainly, I experienced some of your garden variety sexual harassment, which is a really sad thing to say that there is, in fact, garden variety sexual harassment. But, you know, immature comments, making suggestions that a client really liked me and perhaps I could pay them some more attention, all sorts of things. Like, one of my favorite terrible things that happened was there was this person from IT, and this person, every time I saw them, asked me which attorney I worked for. And I don't know if this person thought it was a joke at a certain point or what, but it just crawled on my skin. So, you know, I don't think, gosh, this is going to sound terrible. There was nothing really bad. What does that even mean? I don't know. But it was not the best. And having been at other law firms, I have some sense that it was probably better than some and worse than others there.
Oh, no, I was just thinking about, it goes back to that secretary comment that you were talking about earlier. I know I've shown up for a deposition. There's an assumption that I'm the court reporter. It's probably around the same time frame you're talking about at the law firm. Or if you say you're an attorney, not a court reporter, then who's the attorney that's going to take the deposition? Can you talk a little bit more about some of the, what one might call microaggressions that you've dealt with, or any kind of tokenism as being a woman in a male-dominated profession?
So I was definitely trotted out. It's hard to separate all these things, right? So I know I was asked to interview every female summer associate candidate. Now, was I asked that because I also am a woman? Was I asked that because as a woman, I agreed to things when you asked me to do them? Was it because as a woman, I'm more social and so I'm more likely to make a good impression? I don't know. Some, all. So there was certainly some of that. You know, it's interesting. At the time, there was not as much of an emphasis on diversity within the firm and on client teams. So things that I see happen now where a woman or someone who has a diverse background is trotted out at the pitch, right? To say, look, we have a Black female patent attorney on our team, wasn't happening so much then. And so I didn't experience it in that particular way at that time. So honestly, I have no idea if that's good or bad, but that particular aspect, you know, I didn't deal with.
So Stephanie, the good point is, I know we've spent a lot of time on not the doom and gloom, but what we all experience. But I want listeners to know that there was or is a light at the end of the tunnel for you. Can you tell us how you moved? You spent some time speaking to that month of depression. Tell us how you got out of that and what you moved on to.
Yeah, absolutely. So I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do with myself. And so when And so I hired a career coach. And the first thing I thought was, I want to be a career coach. This is awesome. You help people figure out their lives. There's worksheets. You know, it was amazing. So I met with this person. She was great. She was super helpful. And I decided I'm going to become a law school career counselor, which is like the least impressive job you could ever have among lawyers. For some reason, everybody thinks that the people who do career counseling in law schools are just like could not get anything better, which is, by the way, far from the truth. But I just decided this is my path. And so I started networking up a storm. I started writing blog posts. I learned everything I could about LinkedIn. I was jazzed. And once I decided that I had a plan, I felt better because then I was no longer stuck, right? And so it took many months after this point, but I did it. I got a job as a career counselor back at GW at the law school, and it was great. It was like a breath of fresh air just opened up in my world. I started dating my husband. I got married. I started my own business. I created all sorts of fun stuff. I mean, nobody really cares what the law school career office does, right? As long as they have results. So I created classes. I created everything. I mean, I did a workshop where I went around and the only thing I said was hello. And I just went around and shook everybody's hand. And then I said, that was bad. Do it again. That was bad. Do it again.
I like it.
You know, all sorts of crazy things. So it was super fun.
When you talked earlier about points where you felt lost, or did you feel like you found your way or found room to be your full self when you got into that position?
Yes, I felt, well, first of all, I don't know how much this plays into it, but it was all women. So that was a very different dynamic. And we can spend hours talking about that, but it was different. I think that everyone was there for a reason. People don't go into a job like that just because, right? You know, to pivot from being a practicing attorney to being a career counselor at a law school, usually something has happened to cause that transition. I took classes. I got a graduate certificate. I spoke. I really did. I found there was a lot of room for me to do the things that I was good at and that I enjoyed. The whole job was talking to people and telling them what to do. Two things I love. So it was a lot of fun. But I will tell you, April, I got bored. It took about 2.5 years and I was bored out of my mind. Because remember, I like technology and science and things that are new and sparkly and shiny. And now I'm having the exact same conversation with someone 5 times a day. Your cover letter is a story that explains to an employer why your background is a good fit for their position. Your cover letter is a story again and again. So I had this opportunity to create this world, but then I created it and I was kind of done with it. So as I mentioned before, since I like to learn my lessons twice, I went back to practicing law at a big law firm, which I think, by the way, is no insignificant feat that I was able to go back into that world because everyone told me, forget it. And I should mention that when I quit being an associate, everyone thought I was nuts. People thought I was crazy that I would give up the prestige and the money and all that time and energy. But nothing is lost, right? Nothing is lost. So I got bored working as a career counselor. I went back into practicing law and I did it different this time. I didn't volunteer for anything. I didn't make any friends. I didn't talk to anybody. I ate my lunch at my desk. I did it differently and I was no happier. I mean, I was a little happier. Because I knew more, I was smarter, I understood more, but it still wasn't for me. And this is one of the pivot points. So I was there for probably about 6 months at law firm number 2, and I'm scrolling through IP Law 360, which everybody knows and loves and everybody reads every day, I'm sure, like I do. And I get to the bottom, and in the job postings, there is a position for a patent trainer. And my little antennae are going ding, 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 ding. So I open it. And they're looking for someone who is a patent attorney, has experience working with lawyers, has experience doing training, developing training programs, good at public speaking, good at writing.
They wanted Stephanie Sanders, basically.
That's right. And so I remember I sent it to my husband and he goes, oh, really? You just started this job. And so I interviewed for that job. It was at an IP boutique, although a very well-known one. And I got it. And they had no idea how good they had it. I don't think I know any other person in our field who has that mix of background. And April, that is where the imposter syndrome, I think, started to fade away. Because I realized that now I have these three things, right? The technical, the patent, and the people skills that actually were valuable, that could actually come together to be useful. And I developed a whole series of training programs around patents for associates, new associates, and new, you know, technical specialists at this firm. And also I got to do whatever I wanted, which was really fun. And it was great. I enjoyed it.
Do you think the imposter syndrome faded away from within? Or was it external, or maybe a combination of the two?
I think it was definitely from within. I was like a hexagon, right? And so I found a square and part of me fit in. And then I found a triangle and part of me fit in. And then I found this hexagon, you know, I found where it was close enough. And I don't know my shapes very well. And I fit better. More pieces of me fit, right? I was able to merge more parts of who I was. And that's where I realized, oh, every piece of these things is valuable. And I've met a lot of patent attorneys at that point and more since. And I don't know too many people who are as passionate about training and providing advice and answering questions and helping to build up other people and talking and patent law. Like, what a combination, right?
Do you feel like it would be fair to say you got to be more of your authentic self?
Yes, and only more since then. And that's because I realized that what I had to offer was actually valuable. I wasn't actively suppressing some part. I wasn't actively saying, I'm not going to make friends here because that's just going to eat away my billable hour time. Or I'm going to focus all my energy on this talking creative stuff and totally ignoring the technical side or all the patent experience I had gained.
Let me pull that thread a little bit, because I would like you to give maybe some advice to more junior attorneys about trying to be and striving to be your authentic self and being genuine. Can you talk about that a little bit more?
It's really, really hard. And it's really hard for a number of reasons. Reason number one is, unless you go to law school 20 years into your career, you don't know who you are. It's really hard to be authentic when you're 25 and trying to figure out your life. Maybe I was my most authentic self then, but my authentic self was confused. So I think, don't be so hard on yourself, right? I think that sometimes people say, I'm not being authentic. Well, what does that mean? Well, it's whatever it means to you. There is no truth. There's no ground truth of who you are, right? It's flexible. It changes. And you grow and you learn. So I think that's one piece of advice I would give to younger folks and to past Stephanie if I was speaking with her. But I also think that I would say everything is a journey. I remember being in law school and people being like, if I don't pick the right summer associate position, I am screwed forever. No, that's not true. You know, you don't pick the right job at the front end. It's okay. Chances are good. You're not going to have that job in 4 years anyway. You'll have moved on to something bigger and better. And everything that you learn, you will build upon to find the next thing that's a good fit. I would not have been good in the job I have right now when I graduated law school, or when I left Big Law the first time, or when I left Big Law the second time. I wasn't ready for it until I was ready for it. And so I think for people, there's so much push to be authentic, to be ambitious, to know what you're going to do, to have a plan, to be Kim Davis. People, we cannot all be Kim Davis, okay? We cannot all have a plan at the beginning. It's okay to not know. It's okay to not know. That doesn't mean you're not smart. It doesn't mean you're not ambitious.
I love it. Even the not Kim Davis part, I'll take that. Everyone doesn't want to be me. It's okay.
I do. I think the real point was that not everyone can be you, Kim.
Yeah, that's exactly what I mean. Not everyone can be you. And it's okay.
We're just showing the love here. You talked about your position now, and I'd like you to, if you could, reflect back on that being your authentic self and getting to the point you are now.
When I was at my last firm, I was the trainer, and that morphed into a management position. They call it operations because operation sounds way more fancy than management and administration, but that's essentially what it was. And so people would come to me and say, how do I do this? And I would say, well, that's not really a question of law. That's a question of process. So let's think about it. How should we do this? And so I kind of worked myself both out of my current job and into a new job by answering those questions, and started working with the staff at the firm, managing those who support the patent practice, which, by the way, is like 95% of the sweat, guts and tears, you know, are all of the folks who are the non-attorneys, as we like to call them. Can I make a sidebar on sidebars? Can we stop being an industry of people who say attorneys and non-attorneys? Can we all just be professionals?
Love it.
Okay, I'm done. anyway.
Absolutely. Yeah.
As I was living my best life in my last position and changing things and moving around, I was going to conferences and meeting people and talking and doing my whole Stephanie thing. And one day I get a phone call from a woman named Kathy Mitchell.
We're not familiar with her at all.
You don't know her? No, she's not like the sole driving force of the IP department. No, not her. Okay. Well, anyway, there's this woman, Kathy Mitchell. She's been at this law firm for well over 20 years. She is one of the smartest, most efficient, most effective human beings I've ever met in my entire life. So I get a phone call from her and she says, so-and-so referred me to you. We're looking for a docketing manager. Do you happen to know anyone? I said, I don't know. Let me think about it. And she, it's so funny thinking about it now, knowing her. She tried to be slick and she said something like, well, what about you? Are you looking for a new job? And I was like, well, I don't want to be a docketing manager. She's like, well, we might have something else that might be a fit for you. Which the docketing manager thing was a total pretext, apparently. She just wanted to, you know, to see if I was open to talking. They did need a docket manager. You got one. But anyway. So I said, well, I'm listening. Tell me more. And she said, you know, the firm, I work at Kilpatrick Townsend, and I am the department operations officer for the IP department at the firm. And we are looking for someone to help with all things people, process, and technology for our patent prosecution teams. Is that something you would be interested in? And I, you could imagine me like at my desk, putting my elbows down and my hands on my chin and going, say more, do tell. And she starts describing that the firm has a patent operations committee and that they're committed to improving the, you know, effectiveness of the patent prosecution practice. Oh, and by the way, at this general practice firm, there is the largest patent prosecution practice in the country, bigger than the boutique I was at. And, you know, is this something you're interested in? I was absolutely interested. I interviewed, you know, and I was offered the position to come work at the firm. And I made an executive decision. And I don't exactly know. Well, let me back up. I made the decision, and I'm not sure what prompted it, that I was not going to pretend in any of those interviews. I was not going to put on my best interview face. I was not going to try to not say silly things or be funny. I just didn't have the energy. I was tired. I had a 2-year-old. I just decided I was going to be me.
Authentic.
Authentically me. That's right. At least me at the moment. And it worked. They liked me for me. And I got the job. And, you know, look, I live in the real world. I know that you have to be professional and that sometimes you do things in some contexts and not in others. And certainly you can be more free with some people than others. But I never tried to be more or less than what I was. If I thought something was a good idea, I would just say it. Because what's the worst they could do? Fire me? They're not going to fire me for a bad idea, right? And maybe it's a good idea. You know, if I think something is funny, I laugh. If I think something is dorky, I laugh. You know, whatever it is, there are places and people and positions where you are the fit because of who you are, not because of who you're trying to be, right? And I think that had I tried to be all very important, serious, you know, they would have given me the job anyway. But I think then the firm would have been surprised by who they got after the fact, because I could only keep that up for so long. But I will tell you, April, back to your question about the imposter syndrome, it kind of came back when I started here because it's a big title. My title is Global Patent Operations Chief. That is a title. And I thought, little me, man, there's no way, right? I can't do that job. They can't give me that title. That's ridiculous. But because it was such a good fit, and because the folks at this firm are so amazing, that was short-lived. It faded. I felt so supported. I felt like all of my ideas people would take seriously. That's another thing. Being taken seriously is very important. And the wonderful and talented Kathy Mitchell, who, by the way, sidebar to the sidebar, again, I'm going to do it again. Kilpatrick Townsend was one of the first firms to create a position that was a non-attorney, non-partner management position for a department. So Kathy Mitchell, as the department operations officer, is also a woman in IP law who was a trailblazer. I believe that she was the CFO or the director of finance at one of the predecessor firms, and they recruited her to come over to be the brand new DOO role in the IP department, which she took on with aplomb. and really is the lifeblood of this department.
And I just need to echo that. You are absolutely right. She is the epitome of, I don't know how she does it. She does it all efficiently with grace, and she's the best thing ever. The caring grandmother on the one end, and at the same time, able to answer the question that you have at midnight. So just had to throw that in there. We love you, Kathy.
Including when she's on vacation, yes. By the way, which I know yes. For a fact.
Right. You guys should do an episode on not working on vacation and how to turn off, because Kathy and I talk about that a lot.
We'll definitely talk about that. And I know we're coming up against our time, and I really want to make sure that we get your perspective for the listeners about advice that you would have for someone who finds themselves to be the first or the only in the room.
Be proud to be you, and be proud that you are in that room. That's the only thing I can say. It was when I was an associate and someone would say to me, Stephanie, you know how to work the photocopy machine, right? Go make this copy. I think that had I had the presence of mind to say, yeah, you know what? I do know how to make a photocopy. I'm going to go make that copy, and I'm going to make the best freaking copy you've ever seen. I think that I would have been a lot happier. Now, should they have done that? That's a separate story. But be who you are. Be proud to be there. Know you belong there. And if you find yourself in a place that does not appreciate who you are and what you bring to the table, find another table.
I love that. I really want to thank you for joining us today. I know personally I've gotten so much out of the conversation, and I'm sure our listeners have as well. So thank you very much for your time, Stephanie.
Thank you so much, April. And thank you, Kim. I should say for the listeners, these two women are superstars. You don't even understand what they do in their day job. And then they come together to put this program out there and how much time they spend on this. You guys have no idea. They are rock stars, and I bow down to both of you.
Oh, thank you, Stephanie.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today. If you enjoyed Sidebars, we invite you to check out the Kilpatrick Townsend Medicine and Molecules blog at kilpatricktownsend.com. To read, watch, and listen to other related insight on patent law. We'll also put that information in the show notes. The opinions expressed on this podcast are our own and are not those of Kilpatrick Townsend.
Also, we would love it if you would rate us or leave a review. It helps others find the show. See you next time.